Everyone, welcome to Baird's IPO Reboot Series. I'm Tom Shadwald, a director in Baird's Equity Capital Markets Group, and I'm delighted to be joined here today by Steve Burwell and Mark Schwartz for the recording of our second episode of the series on preparation for public listing. For those who missed the first session, the Reboot Series is really a series to act as a practical guide for private companies looking to learn the ABCs of going public. We cover topics from IPO preparation all the way to what to do once you're publicly listed. Today's session, like I said, is on the preparation for public listing, and I'll hand it over to Steve to introduce himself.
Hi, everyone. This is Steve Burwell. I'm a partner at Proskauer Rose in the Capital Markets Practice Group. I've been practicing for about 24 years at a few different law firms and in-house counsel at a major investment bank.
Hi, it's Mark Schwartz. I lead our IPO and SPAC capital markets advisory practice at Ernst & Young. We're independent transaction advisors, helping companies go public, either IPO, SPAC, direct listing. Spent 15 years on the street in equity capital markets at a couple of different banks, including where I met Steve and Tom.
Great. Thanks, guys. And so I think without further ado, we'll move into kind of a moderated panel with some Q&A. And so the first question here for Steve, what advisors and consultants are typically involved in an IPO process? And how should private company executives look to engage them and kind of at what time as they think about the lead up to the IPO process?
Yeah, thanks, Tom. It's a great question. I think first and foremost, taking a look at your outside auditors, every private company, of course, is going to have outside auditors, but it may be a firm that's smaller, a little bit more regional, maybe doesn't have much public company experience. And I think if you are in that situation, you're going to want to make an upgrade pretty quickly, just because the new auditing firm may need to go back and re-audit prior financials. It's going to take them some time to get up to speed. I think I'd also say the same about your outside counsel. Again, most of these private companies are going to have outside counsel, but if it's a smaller firm without much IPO experience, you're definitely going to want to come in and get a more world-class firm pretty quickly. Sometimes private companies also engage underwriters counsel. That's the law firm representing the banks early on, even though those lawyers would be representing the banks. Sometimes you see a firm that has historically been across from a private company, either representing banks in a lending relationship or representing another party across from the firm. And it's a law firm that already knows the company, even from an adversarial relationship. But again, having somebody that has some familiarity with you, even though they're not going to be your counsel, can be very helpful. In some deals, there's even a third law firm that's involved if they're selling shareholders and those in the IPO, and those shareholders might be adverse or have some different interests to the company, then you might have a third firm that's just representing the selling shareholders. So moving away from law firms, I'd say next up, and again, there's no necessarily a sequence here, but next up would be engaging your investment banks. It's pretty common to have three or four investment banks leading your IPO, but there's going to be a series of smaller investment banks that might be involved in more minor roles. Some firms like to have an IPO advisor that's a more boutique bank that's just working with them directly. And then there's a series of consultants you may need, compensation consultants to make sure that your public company compensation package is up to snuff and on par with similar companies, a public relations firm, an investor relations firm. And then I guess finally, industry and market data experts to work with you on sort of all the market data that's going to go into your IPO prospectus. That's a long litany of advisors, but I hope I've answered the question.
No, that's great, Steve. I think the kind of headline comment I would make there is it's important to kind of build an IPO team around yourself. It is a long process, and there are certainly a lot of work streams. And so while you need internal quarterbacks from a company perspective, it's also important, I think, early on in the process to kind of seek the help of some outside advisors to alleviate some of the distraction it may cause from running the day-to-day business as you think about kind of how to build that team around an IPO. So maybe over to Mark, accounting and reporting, often very long poles kind of in the IPO tent. What are some of the key considerations from your perspective on how to attack those?
So there's probably a couple of areas where I think companies that are further along in the process wish that they had had some guidance on earlier in the process to sort of be a little bit more ready or readier on the spectrum of readiness earlier in the process. I think one is with respect to the audits. From a private company perspective, the overwhelming majority of companies are audited to CPA standards or private company standards. Once you are looking to file a registration statement, you will need public company audits. The biggest difference between private company audits and public company audits are with respect to the amount of substantive testing that's required to get to a public company audit opinion. That testing can be done in connection with ongoing audits once a company realizes or begins to think that it is heading down an IPO path. The PCAOB audit does not need to and won't be issued along the way, but instead of going back either 2 years or 3 years, depending on how many years of financial statements you're going to have in your document, instead of going back and reopening or retesting or beginning to expand testing as you go down or closer to the IPO execution period, one of the things that companies are doing and do to sort of be ready and avoid that issue is expand the testing in connection with sort of the ongoing audits in the couple of years leading up to a potential public process. Two other things on the accounting and reporting side I'd probably mention. One is with respect to non-GAAP measures. Most, if not all, private companies are very facile and look at, you know, very detailed non-GAAP measures in running their day-to-day business as a private company. Understanding and knowing what public market investors, research analysts, and frankly, the SEC will be looking for with respect to these non-GAAP measures. Doing that earlier in the process and seeing how the street effectively will view them and will be able to view the company, I think is important earlier than is typically done for these private companies. And then three is with respect to key performance indicators or KPIs. Companies typically, I'll say, look at KPIs that drive their business on a directional basis when they're private, a little bit more eyeballing or spitballing as they go. But what happens is, as you get close to an SEC process and you want to put some of this historical data into a registration statement or share it with investors, share it with research analysts, the process around how verifiable this information is often comes into question later on, and frankly, too late, where companies need to kind of go back and think through or rethink through or revalidate or validate the information from called prior periods. And frankly, a lot of times they're not able to get to a point where they and counsel are comfortable with it. And they often end up needing to go without it in the registration process and in the marketing process, which is never ideal.
Yeah, that's a great point, Mark, as you think about kind of some of the stuff as you're preparing for the IPO, is just to revisit some of those critical kind of metrics and performance indicators and make sure that they fit in the public markets kind of box. And so maybe Steve, I know we just talked about some of the longer lead time items from an accounting and reporting perspective, but given you're our resident legal expert on the phone today, what are some of the longer lead time items from a legal documentation and from a diligence perspective?
Yeah, sure. So some of the longer lead time items can be just structural at the outset. I mean, for example, if the company is an LLC or a partnership or an S corp or something, it's almost definitely going to want to convert to a C corp for a public company listing. And sometimes jurisdiction of incorporation may need to be changed. Again, it's not a requirement, but the vast majority of public companies are headquartered in, or not headquartered, but are incorporated in Delaware. So you may want to consider reincorporating in Delaware just to take advantage of the long history of jurisprudence that's available there. A company might want to consider a stock split, a reverse stock split, increase authorized shares, make other changes to their certificate of incorporation or bylaws. I mean, again, all these things are pretty simple to do when you're a closely held private company, but get much more complicated if you're a public company. Some companies have multiple classes of stock or stock with supermajority voting rights. Again, these are things that public companies can have, but you at least, as Mark noted, want to like take a good hard look at these issues and make sure they make sense. Talk to your investment bankers, talk to your lawyers, and just see if they're what you really want as a public company. You know, other sort of early items I would flag is reviewing stockholder agreements, you know, seeing if certain parties have registration rights, if anyone has preemptive rights, if anyone has consent rights to you going public. Taking a look at material contracts as well, contracts with vendors, lenders, other sort of third parties you work with. And then, you know, turning to the S-1 itself, I don't think it's ever too early to start working on the business section. You know, you sort of typically start working on that once the investment banks are engaged, but some private companies already have sort of precedent documents, either from private capital raises or maybe from a sell side process that didn't go anywhere. You can at least always start with that and maybe start making some basic updates. You can look at comparable companies that are public companies for guidance. And sort of use those as a starting place. I mean, every company is unique, so you're never just kind of copying and pasting language, but you can at least look to those documents as guidance to see how companies in a similar industry address risks, address strengths. And then gathering the factual backup and market data to support the S-1 is often a very time-consuming process. As I mentioned earlier, you're often working with industry experts or market data providers. You might have to seek their consent to use data in an S-1. So that's a process I would recommend starting early. And then, you know, I think the final thing that I would recommend a private company get moving on in terms of documentation and due diligence is just getting organized for due diligence. I mean, the investment banks and their counsel and your counsel are going to be spending a lot of time going through all of your material agreements and certificate of incorporation and bylaws and leases, sort of any kind of contract you may have, litigation history. Again, if you've had a prior M&A process or maybe a prior financing, maybe all that stuff is nicely and neatly organized into a virtual data room. But if it's not, that's going to take some time. And again, I would just recommend getting started on that early.
Thanks, Steve. Maybe for you, Mark, from capital markets preparation perspective, what do you usually tell companies who are 1 to 3 years out from a public listing to focus on?
So we get that question a lot. There's a handful of things that I think companies can begin once public markets become a twinkle in their eye. One is beginning to create a presence in the marketplace. So whether that is establishing a pattern of regularly released business information, updates to just sort of business products, et cetera, key initiatives. Establishing that pattern, I think, well before going down the IPO path is very helpful from a number of perspectives and sort of starts getting the message out there. Same with participation in some of the industry conferences. The industry conferences have just a ton of market participants in or around them. Beginning to get a company's name out there, just on the radar for some of the participants, I think is very helpful. We often tell companies as well to study the various paths to getting public earlier on in the process. So company may think it's, you know, IPO or bust right up front. There may be an interloping SPAC or other type of transaction that comes in, but using some of the downtime before getting to that fast and furious point to really understand some of the economics, best use cases, sort of prior transactions, regardless of path, so direct listing, SPAC, or IPO. How these processes actually work and come together, I think, is very helpful before you get into the thick of things. And then finally, and amongst the most important, I think, is with respect to the company's model. Obviously, private companies use their models for budgeting, for, you know, for managing cash and the like. But ultimately, the model from a public company perspective needs to be highly predictive and highly, I'll say, attuned to the business from a forward perspective. So using the model as part of managing the business, using the model to begin to predict your results, even while you're a private company, is extremely helpful. And we actually counsel companies to begin to provide guidance internally, obviously, but, you know, kind of use the model to come up with guidance on a public company schedule. So X number of days post quarter end for the forward quarter, for the forward year, on certain metrics that they believe they will ultimately look to guide on, with certain precision and ranges that will, you know, would be used as a public company. And then most importantly, going back and looking 30 days later, 60 days later, and more, back at the guidance, how predictive it was, and continually trying to improve the predictability in the model, I think is certainly the key to getting to a model that is most usable once you're public.
Thank you, Mark. Maybe switching kind of topics a little bit here for you, Steve. How should private companies begin to think about kind of board requirements and governance more broadly as they look to access the public markets?
Yeah, it's a good question. And it's one that we get a lot, just because the board and the CEO's relationship with the board, of course, is one of the most important things that a company is going to be dealing with. And I'd say, you know, typically in a private company, you have board members that have been around for a long time. I mean, you know, if the private company is majority held by a private equity firm or a VC, often it's just three or four representatives of the VC. You may have some people that are, how should I put it, resistant to change and maybe sort of like the way things have been working. But as is going to be apparent in a public company context, you're probably going to almost certainly going to have to bring on new board members. And the working relationship with those new board members is of critical importance. So let's just start with some of the requirements. I mean, both the New York Stock Exchange and the NASDAQ require a majority independent board. You know, there are some exceptions for what we call controlled companies that have, you know, more than a 50% large shareholder and foreign private issuers. But I would say in practice that even if you are able to take advantage of some of these exceptions, you may not want to, just because from a governance standpoint, often the large institutional investors that you're going to be courting in the IPO process and the proxy advisory firms prefer an independent board. Everybody just sees that as good sort of market standard corporate governance. So, you know, with your current board members, the first thing you're going to have to do is just understand if anyone qualifies as independent. I mean, there's a kind of customary process where you give everybody a director and officer questionnaire, and you know, you ask sort of a standard list of questions. If you know the director has been employed by the company, or if a family member has been employed, or if they have some kind of contractual relationship with the company, or a family member might, there's sort of any number of things that are going to bounce a director from being not independent. And of course, if you have any one factor that makes you not independent, you're not independent. So almost definitely you're going to have to go out and find some new directors. You know, within each of the standard committees, you're going to have a standing audit committee, a compensation committee, a nominating and governance committee, and all of those committees are going to be comprised or should be comprised of independent board members. And there's a number of skill requirements that your board members are going to need. You have to have three members on your audit committee with a certain level of financial literacy. And then one of them must meet the higher threshold of being a quote unquote financial expert. depending on the industry you're in, you might need certain other expertise now that you're a public company that maybe you didn't need as a private company. So you're out there looking for board members that meet independence requirements. You're out there looking for board members that have skill with respect to financial literacy and these other issues. And then I guess I'll close just talking a little bit about board diversity. NASDAQ has rules requiring a certain number of diverse directors, or if you don't have a certain number of diverse directors, an explanation on why you don't. A couple of states also have similar rules. And I'd say even outside of these legal requirements, as I mentioned, the proxy advisory firms, the institutional investors, and even some investment banks look very hard at boards that don't at least have some level of racial, ethnic, and gender diversity. So these are things that you're going to want to think about pretty hard as a private company. And as noted, they just take a lot of lead time to find the right people and people that are also, from a cultural standpoint, work well with your other directors and your management.
Thank you, Steve. Maybe over to Mark here for this one. How should companies think about equity story development as they begin preparing for the IPO process?
Yep. So I like what Steve said before, which is it's never too early to begin working on your equity story. I think the benefits of working on an equity story well ahead of an IPO are really around aligning the various stakeholders. It is amazing to me how differently different folks around the table, from management to board to owners, et cetera, look at the equity story. And it's not until people are forced to sort of coalesce around a story that some of this starts coming to light. Inevitably, there's kind of two ways that this comes together in an IPO process. One is you're at that point where you say, okay, we have bankers and let's get in a room, and the bankers kind of take the lead and they hold the pen, and you know, management in some ways kind of looks around and says, yeah, that's right, that's kind of right, or you know, kind of goes along with the process. Inevitably, in those cases, the story is very directionally right, but not exactly management's precise story. And that becomes the story that management needs to own and live with in the quarters and thereafter at IPO. And frankly, I think, you know, oftentimes it takes management teams a number of quarters to effectively tailor and hone that story, but they're doing so in the public eye. So never ideal. And I think when you talk to those management teams, if you kind of gave them a chance to rewind the clock and, you know, back up to a couple of quarters or more before IPO and have actually sat there and forced themselves to kind of tell the story together amongst themselves prior to being influenced, prior to having the time clock ticking of, you know, hey guys, we're filing on X date, et cetera. I think you would find that companies who have gone through this process would have preferred to go through the more methodical process. The other benefit to starting early, like Steve says, and actually working this on an internal company basis, is you do have a very significant opportunity to test your thoughts with members of the analyst community. Meetings are permitted, permissible, certainly well ahead of IPO. Analysts can be pretty candid. It can be a pretty, a fulsome two-way dialogue. And I think the analysts can be quite beneficial for companies that are thinking through their story and how they want to position themselves within the market. Same thing with investors, investors who are potentially crossover investors, investors who are very interested in the space, both learning about the space for other investments that they have and learning about potential future new opportunities within the space. I think speaking to them can be quite enlightening. And bankers are always willing to provide their time for free. Well up front, they get to know companies. Companies get to, reap the benefit of the sector knowledge from the investment bankers. So you know, once again, I like the way Steve put it, and never too early to get started.
Yeah, Mark, and if I could just build on that a little bit, I mean, I think also it's important to vet this with counsel. You know, it's funny, the number of drafting sessions that I've sat in early on in the process where you start to sort of flesh out what the story will be, and you hear all these words like unique and best in class and top notch and, you know, we're the greatest, and, you know, which is all wonderful from a marketing standpoint. But as I noted earlier, of course, everything that's going to be in the S1 has to be tested and diligent and backed up. So you often find that you have this wonderful story, and it can still be wonderful and very positive from a marketing standpoint, but you just need to dial it back a little bit and sort of rein back some of the marketing terms and do something that's going to be appropriate from a risk standpoint.
That's an excellent point, Steve. And both Steve and Mark, I think, thank you very much for your time. For folks tuned in, I'm sure this has been an incredibly insightful discussion for everyone. I know that I've personally picked up a handful of talking points that I'm going to be using moving forward as well. So thank you guys. We appreciate your time. Once again, this is the Baird IPO Reboot Series. We'll be back in a couple of weeks with a new episode on some of the do's and don'ts around pre-IPO activity. And so with that, Mark, Steve, thank you again, and we'll tune out until next time.
Thank you.